Hello and welcome to SkinCast, the podcast that teaches you how to take the very best care of the skin you are in. I am one of your hosts. My name is Luke Johnson. I'm a pediatric dermatologist and general dermatologist with the University of Utah. I know you guys are used to hearing Dr. Michelle Tarbox talk at the beginning here. We had some technical difficulties, so you won't hear her at the beginning or at the end, but you will hear her in the middle. Michelle and I are both medical doctors. We're both board-certified dermatologists. Michelle is at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in beautiful, sunny Lubbock, Texas. And we have a guest today as well, so hopefully you won't be missing Michelle too much over the past 40 seconds. Yes, we have a special guest. This is Dr. Fane Frey. Dr. Frey, thanks so much for joining us. Do you want to start by introducing yourself?
Sure. I'm a board-certified dermatologist practicing in New York. I have been doing so for over 3 decades. I've also spent many, many years analyzing skincare products and objectively testing formulations for many years. And it's a wonderful honor, and I thank you for inviting me on today.
We're so happy to have you. And it sounds like us, one of your missions is to make sure that patients know what over-the-counter stuff is appropriate and what might not be. In fact, you have recently written a book about it called The Skincare Hoax, How You're Being Tricked into Buying Lotions, Potions, and Wrinkle Cream.
I did write this book, and I'm proud of this book. And let me tell you what motivated me to write this book, if I may.
Please.
So I know, and you all probably know, that the most important information on any skincare product is the ingredient listing. Mm-hmm. And you probably also know that most consumers don't understand the ingredients like isopropyl myristate and triethanolamine and phenoxyethanol. So it's pretty much a blind item. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I'm not even sure a lot of my colleagues have gotten into the chemistry of skincare products, barring a few ingredients that they may be familiar with. I also know that people are overwhelmed with choice and confused because the front panel is what we all purchase, base our purchases on. And that to me is marketing real estate. So mm-hmm. I've seen thousands of patients, I'm sure you folks have too, who feel bad about themselves because of some trivial skin imperfection, perhaps, and the yeah. amount of time, energy, and money they spend on these repairing these self-perceived flaws. And these are accomplished women, mind you. I was motivated to advocate for the consumer, so I wrote the skincare hoax.
I'm grateful you're doing this kind of work because there has been this sort of nuclear proliferation of skincare lines that has been facilitated by online outlets, and there's direct-to-consumer retailing through Facebook and Instagram of a lot of boutique products that have sort of mysterious origins and potentially even more mysterious contents. So I think that educating the lay public is an important imperative, actually, mission for dermatologists at large, and I'm grateful for this tool in the armamentarium. So what tactics do you use to help people understand the landscape, the complex and ever-changing landscape of over-the-counter available consumable skincare?
Well, first, I think we have to educate the consumer. You know, the consumer doesn't understand the difference between cosmetic and drug. This is an important concept. In this country, we have a law, 1938, right? The Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act was passed, and it defined a drug as something that changes the structure or function of your skin. And if it's a drug, it has to go through FDA and get pre-market approval, and it has to prove efficacy and safety. And we have a great system there. Cosmetics, on the other hand, are there to adorn. Okay, they really can't, by law, intend to change the structure or function of skin. So this big armamentarium of over-the-counter cosmetics, where people are confused, by definition are not intended to change the structure or function of skin. And manufacturers know this. So my first goal is to educate the consumer, to let them know that by mere fact it's a cosmetic limits what it could really do for the skin.
That makes sense.
I hadn't thought about it that way before, but that makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I know that that also limits the kind of claims that companies can make about what the product can and can't do. And they have some creative ways of getting around that. Also, the sort of fly-by-night online retailers, here today, gone tomorrow people, don't abide by those rules because they are not following most of the laws. So there are products that are being retailed as cosmetics that make claims that they can't substantiate, like can give a, you know, can help make age spots disappear or something like that, which would be changing the function or structure of the skin. But, you know, if they're unregulated because they're maybe originating in a country outside of ours, those claims are labeled into the product. And then if somebody makes a complaint, that company dissolves, reforms under a different name and continues to sell the same goop in a different bottle.
Well, claims are important, and it's very specific. There's legitimate claims that are appropriate for drugs. Like, you'll rarely see on a cosmetic gets rid of your wrinkles. What you'll see is decreases the appearance of fine lines and wrinkles. See, that's compliant language for a cosmetic. It doesn't get rid of them, but just by hydrating. So it might be a great moisturizer. You take a raisin, you pump water into it, you have a grape temporarily. Let me ask you, is that anti-wrinkle?
Not really. No.
Okay, so that's that. They're allowed to do that. So the claims are very compliant, and there are compliance and regulators for these big companies so that they don't make these kinds of mistakes. Cosmetic companies advocate for themselves, and they should, right? They're advocating for their shareholders, and the media is advocating for the media. It wants the attention, and there is very little advocating going on for the consumer.
I agree with that. And what I usually tell my patients is stuff like, generally, you can keep it simple and that's fine. So everybody should probably be using a sunscreen. For kiddos, I recommend mineral-based sunscreens because, you know, those recent studies that chemical-based sunscreens get absorbed into the blood. I say we don't know that they do anything bad in the blood, but just to make sure, for kids, I recommend the zinc, titanium, possibly iron oxide stuff. And then probably everybody who's not pregnant or breastfeeding should be using a retinol. You know, there's inexpensive over-the-counter adapalene, for example. And then, of course, we can prescribe some. And then, you know, good moisturizers. I like plain old petroleum jelly. Mm-hmm. It's kind of messy. So I think, you know, shea butter, coconut oil, other good options as well. And then all of the other stuff that people use, oftentimes I'll bring them in and I'll say, well, I don't really think this is bad. You know, it's got ingredients in here that look like it could do what you want. But my suspicion is that it's overpriced. And that's sort of where I leave my discussion of over-the-counter products. Uh-huh. Is there more that you tell people?
Well, first of all, I don't want to villainize the skincare industry. It's a fantastic industry, and it really does make great products. It makes great sunscreens, which we all know is probably the single best product to prevent skin damage, skin cancer, and good moisturizers, which we all know hydrated skin is best for patients, especially those with eczema and probably psoriasis and seborrhea. There's a lot of conditions where moisturized or hydrated skin is optimal. But with that being said, the marketing tactics that are being used to mislead, a great formulation, a well-formulated moisturizer, it does not guarantee its success. It's the marketing that guarantees its success. So I want patients to be so mindful of that marketing and so mindful of the influences that that marketing is having on them that they're dangerous. They're really dangerous consumers.
I like that idea, dangerous consumer. It's yes. Kind of like the Ariana Grande song, Dangerous Woman, but a little bit more inclusive and also arming people to enter the healthcare and skincare space. Well, and I'm grateful you're addressing, like, so there's sort of the legitimate cosmetics world that, you know, L'Oreal, Roche-Posay, companies that have a tradition of safety and you know, a presence in the industry for a long time. And then there's these little startup things that have flourished in the era of you know, internet consumerism. And, you know, some of those I've actually had patients bring to my office, and the ingredients, if they're even accurately what's in the product, mm-hmm. are somewhat distressing. I had a patient that had something that was for itching, and one of the top labeled ingredients in it was actually toxicodendron extract. So it was like poison ivy extract. And predictably, sure. This patient's rash was getting worse. But when I looked up the kind of company to try to see if I could find any more information about it, it had already been dissolved. And she'd only bought the product 6 months prior. So I know that there's also some entry into the healthcare space because of the lower purchasing power required by smaller entities that may even be less regulated than traditional cosmetics. So I think educating patients about those as well is very important. So I'm grateful for that sort of step towards helping our patients be more savvy consumers.
Yes, I actually recommend the bigger companies. These bigger companies have the resources. They have the resources to get better ingredients, better testing. Not that a lot of testing is done, depending on what budgets are allowed, but these bigger manufacturers, and they also have a reputation to uphold, by the way. Keep in mind that almost 200 different brands are owned by only 7 companies.
Yeah.
Right. So it's really it's a big industry. It's a growing industry. But again, it's a blind item because the consumer doesn't really know what's in it. They don't understand the ingredient listing. And the marketing real estate on the front of the bottle is really a fair game for anyone to be had. So anyway, there's a need for this type of education of the consumer.
How do you feel about people making their own cosmetic products at home?
Well, again, the problem with that is minimal testing, minimal preservation. Any water-based product is going to grow mold and bacteria probably within 11, 12 days. I'm not sure that's a wise thing to be putting cosmetics around your mouth and your nose and your eyes that is contaminated. And the preservatives or the lack thereof in these homegrown DIY concoctions. So I don't normally recommend that.
Do you find that the industry has gotten grumpy with you, Dr. Frey, for all of this work?
Actually, just the opposite. I have, first I should tell you, I don't sell any products and I don't work for any skincare manufacturer. But I do have a lot of them come to my office and we talk. I speak to the cosmetic chemists and I like the big guys because, again, they have the resources. I have gotten a lot of encouragement from colleagues, in particular ones that aren't selling so much or pushing their cosmetics again in their office. And I'm not necessarily against that, but again, are they really advocating for their patients or are they being influenced by their profits? And so I've had the opposite. Patients, friends, family, consumers have absolutely embraced me. I have been very, very welcomed by the news media and not as welcomed by the beauty industry for obvious reasons.
Yeah, there's a lot of money invested in sort of magnifying small flaws and then getting people to spend a lot of time and energy on them, like you said. And I do think that there's a move towards more inclusive advertising, which I think is a helpful step because the traditional sort of European ethnocentric version of beauty that has been the bastion of what everyone has been told to aspire to in the United States for the past 50 years is starting to be more inclusive of people with different kinds of skin types, different kinds of hair, different kinds of beauty aesthetics.
It's a very consumer-driven industry. If women didn't buy eye creams, companies wouldn't make them. So if we can educate the consumers as to maybe emphasize more wellness rather than beauty, I think that would make a huge shift in inclusivity and what companies made. And I'm not against the beauty industry, by the way. I can give you my analogy to that if you'd like it.
I would like it.
Okay, my analogy with the beauty industry is that of like, it reminds me of sprinkles on an ice cream cone. So sprinkles are fun and sprinkles are playful and they're colorful. But you don't need them, right? So I feel this way about the beauty industry. I have nothing wrong with women who want to buy something because it's fun and it makes them feel, you know, it's beautiful, it's colorful, I should say, and it makes them feel good. That's all well and good. But to think that that's going to really improve your health or well-being, in my opinion, is a fallacy. And so I'm not against the beauty industry. I just like to keep it in perspective.
And you are for empowering consumers.
I'm for empowering consumers and letting them know that most consumers, especially women, and I pick women in particular, because there are so many accomplished women in particular who really feel bad about themselves. And so I want to remind women that you're already fabulous, despite these imperceived flaws. Number two, there's no correlation between the cost of a product and what you pay and its efficacy. So a simple regimen that's inexpensive can be just as effective as those fancy expensive ones. Those are kind of my tidbit reminders to women. I do have a website, Fryface, where I don't sell anything, just to help people pick product. And it's usually these bigger companies, the products that are on the website, Fryface, FryFace.com. There's a product selector just to help people pick product before they go to their big drugstore and all to make a good selection. I test the products in my office.
That's awesome. What a nice resource to offer to patients. I think that we could make you a theme song. You could be like, so Dr. Frey, you make me feel like a dangerous consumer.
Sing it, Michelle.
All right. Well, that's great. I want to close by quoting you to yourself. This is a quote from you, apparently. Kindness matters. Health matters. Accomplishments matter. None of those things come in a tube or bottle. And I think that's a very empowering statement.
I'm going to put that on my wall. I love that.
So thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Frey.
Hope you all learned something from it.
And that is all for today. Thank you to Dr. Fry for joining us today to discuss empowering consumers. Thanks, of course, to our institutions. Thanks to the University of Utah for supporting this podcast. And thanks to Texas Tech for lending us Michelle. If you would like to hear more of us, and more of Michelle for sure, you can hear us on our other podcast. It's called Dermasphere, D-E-R-M-A, Sphere. It's aimed at dermatologists and other clinicians practicing clinical dermatology. But if you're a total dermatology nerd like we are, you don't have to be a doctor to listen to it. Hopefully you'll still get something good out of it. That is all for now, and we'll see you guys next time.